All right, we are here to study eschatology, ology. You know that means study of, essentially, theology, study of theos, word for God, Christology, study of Christ. Eschaton is the Greek word for last things or last days. Eschatology is the study of last day things. That was easy, wasn't it? Those are the basics. Now, I'm going to go back and start from scratch. We had covered some of this material a year ago when we were still, 2 years, is that it? When we were over at the house. But there are so many folks that are here that haven't heard it, and we have such a large listening audience now on the internet that we didn't have before that we're just going to start from scratch. Just so you know, in the month of August, MP3 downloads of messages, we did 549 downloads last month. So there is this extended audience out there, and of course, if they also study the eschatology stuff with us, we're looking at 1,000 downloads a month easily, and we topped 900 individual users last month, which is the highest in terms of just individual folks coming by the website and spending time with us, and we're doing 18,000 hits a month on average. So that's a lot of people coming to the website and paying attention. So we're going to start all over for everybody, you all and the people on the internet. I came out of a church in California that was predominantly Arminian in their thinking. I think most of you know what that means. I come out of a free willist sort of background. And when I came to know the doctrines of grace, one of the things that I had studied extensively in California was eschatology. I was very involved in and very interested in eschatology and had years of study behind it. And so when I came to the doctrines of grace for the first time and came to understand the doctrines of grace, the God that I had always known through eschatology, the God who announced the future in advance, the God who had the future in his hands, the God who was sovereign enough to control nations and move people, was the very same God that I then understood in terms of salvation. Most people understand God's sovereignty in terms of salvation and then are introduced to the eschatological side of God and say, why, that same God who is sovereign in my salvation is also sovereign in moving people around and controlling the future. I sort of did it the backwards way. I understood God's sovereignty in eschatology and in prophecy before I ever understood his sovereignty in salvation. And so I had no conflict in the position that I already held, which I'll explain to you in a moment. I had no conflict between my position and the sovereign God. Now, when I say position, largely when you're talking eschatology, there are three major positions that historically for the last 2,000 years have been promoted inside the church. And the way that the three positions are delineated have to do with what's called the millennium. Whenever you hear me say the word millennium, I'm talking about the 1,000 years that are referenced in Revelation 20. Someday, we will get all the way to Revelation 20, and we'll talk about the millennium. Now, Jesus may come before we get there, but someday we'll get all the way to Revelation 20, and we'll actually talk about it. But there is 1,000 years spoken of 6 different times in Revelation 20. The term 1,000 years is spelled out very clearly, 1,000 years. So there have been 3 different approaches to that fact, the 1,000 years, the millennium. The 3 different approaches fall into these 3 broad categories. The first is called premillennialism. In other words, if you believe that Jesus is coming back to planet Earth, and you believe that he's coming back in a physical way, if you believe that Jesus is going to physically return to planet Earth, that at the beginning of the book of Acts, when he sailed off into the blue, his apostles were standing there watching him leave, and an angel appeared to them and said, "Ye men of Judea, why do you stand here gazing up into the heavens? This same Jesus will return in like manner as you've seen him go." Now that's your promise right there, that he's going to return to earth in this same like manner, which was caught up in the clouds of glory, that he's going to come back in clouds of glory. And that he's going to come back in that same physical body that he, when he was raised out of the tomb, that he came up in a physical body. There's been a lot of debate through the years by the Gnostics and different groups who have said that it wasn't a physical body, it was a spirit body, that, you know, his physical body died and then he raised in some, you know, ghostly spiritual form. But he sat, he ate, he drank, he talked, and he said to Thomas, "Touch my side, touch my hands, put your fingers in the holes in my side," proving that it was a physical body. That's why he did it. This is a tangible, physical body. So Jesus coming back in a physical body, if he comes back before the 1,000 years, that is the premillennial stance. Now, if you believe that the 1,000 years that was spoken of in Revelation 20 is actually meant to mean a broad expanse of time, but not necessarily 1,000 literal actual years, then you are what's called an amillennialist. All that that means is, you know that in the Greek language they have this neat little trick. This is the first Greek letter in the alphabet, like that. The alpha is the name of that letter, pronounced a. You can take just about any word in the Greek language and put that in the front of it, and what you've done is you've reversed that word. It's the same word going in the opposite direction. It's a very neat trick. It's something we ought to have in the English language. When you can't think of the opposite of something, you can just say that thing and put the ah in front of it. You know, it's the opposite thing. For instance, I just used the word Gnostics. Gnostics were a group of folk who believed that they had special revelation from God, that they had a knowing, which is what Gnostic means, is knowing. That they had a knowing from God that was unique to them. So Gnosticism is a knowing. Put the A in front of it, we pronounce it agnostic. That means not knowing. I don't know. Is there a God? Is there not? I don't know. Agnostic. Theist, someone who believes in God. Atheist, we pronounce it atheist, no God. You get the picture here? See how this works? Okay. Millennium means 1,000 years. A millennium, not 1,000 years. Rather, a broad expanse of time, sometimes called the Golden Age. In other words, a period of time from when Christ died till he comes back that encompasses what's called, or what is believed to be, the reference in Revelation 20. The Revelation 20 says 1,000 years, what it really meant was an expanse of time between when Jesus left and when Jesus came back. We'll get into the development of each of these theories as we go on. Or each of these positions, I shouldn't call them theories.
Now is the millennium?
So that we're living in the millennium now, that the church age is Revelation 20's 1,000 years, and then Jesus will come back at some point at the end of this millennium golden age period. When that is closed, Jesus will come back. The third position is actually kind of an offshoot of that amillennial point. It does believe that the 1,000 years will at some point close. Usually, they'll say that that 1,000 years will close when the church is triumphant, once the church has taken over planet Earth. The church triumphant, if you've ever heard that language, the church triumphant. And that's becoming very popular. That notion's becoming very popular now on TBN, and in some of the Pentecostal and charismatic groups are accepting that notion that the church is going to progress in power and progress in influence until it creates an earth that is worthy of the return of Christ, and then Christ will return at the end of this golden age period. That's called post-millennialism. So you've got premillennialism, Christ will be back before the 1,000 years. You've got post-millennialism, which is Christ will be back after the 1,000 years. And you have amillennialism, which says that the 1,000 years is not 1,000 years exactly, but rather a wide expanse of time. So, Jim, which of those three positions do you adhere to? Well, that's why we're here. I am an adamant pre-millennialist. I believe that the millennium is a time future to us that has not begun yet. And I believe that for a whole lot of reasons. Everywhere that you see the millennium described in the Bible, Old and New Testament, there are particular attributes that the millennium has that are really hard to say exist now. For instance, Jeremiah 31, when you talk about the promise of the new covenant, the first time you see the new covenant promised, it's in Jeremiah 31. You see it repeated verbatim in Hebrews chapter 8. And both times that you read the new covenant, it says the exact same thing, which is that God says the attributes of the new covenant will be shared with Israel and Judah in particular. That hasn't happened yet, so that makes me think there's yet more to do. It also says that when it happens, there will be no need for any man to teach his brother or to say, know the Lord, because from the greatest to the least, they will all know me in their hearts. And I will write my law in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Meanwhile, when you see Paul talk about the church and the existence of the church, he says that there are gifts given to the church, some apostles, some prophets, some pastors and teachers. Well, what is the point of having teachers to the church if we are living in an age where there's no need for any man to teach his brother or say, know the Lord, because they all know me from the greatest to the least? When you see those kind of descriptions of what the millennial period will be like, there's just no way to conclude that what we're living in right now is the millennial period. One of the descriptions that Ezekiel gives and that Isaiah described, you know, of the millennial period is a time when babies will sit on the holes where poisonous snakes live, and they'll reach down into the den of the poisonous snakes and pull them out, and nothing will hurt nor harm in all my holy mountain. And bears will lay down with lambs, and, you know, lions and sheep, and they won't hurt or harm or eat each other. So I often say, well, if you want a proof that we're not living in the millennial period, it's really not hard to prove. You get yourself a bear. You get yourself a sheep, you put them in a room together, you see who wins. And if somebody wins, you're not in the millennium yet. Yes?
Back to what you were mentioning months ago about the men knowing God and not having to be taught and everything.
Right.
Is it possible that you're talking about two different sects here? You know, of course, we talked about in the past about Israel.
Absolutely.
And all that, and then
right.
The church being the Gentile
right.
church. Could they be two different?
Absolutely. You're just way ahead of me because you've had some of this teaching. Here's the point. You cannot understand the book of Revelation and most of the confusion about the book of Revelation that's going on and so many of the books that are being written right now and all the Left Behind stuff and all the John Hagee stuff that's being written about the book of Revelation takes it all from a completely Gentile church perspective. And you can't possibly understand the book of Revelation if you haven't done your Israelology, if you don't understand the history of Israel, and if you don't understand the prophetic development within Israel and the promises made to Israel and how they're played out in the book of Revelation. You can't understand it. In the book of Revelation, there's all of this very Jewish language. Other than the book of Matthew, the most Jewish book in the New Testament is the book of Revelation. And you've got talk of temple, and you've got talk of law, and you've got talk of priests, and you've got 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. You've got all this very Jewish, Israelitish language that then people have to go through great machinations and work very hard to explain away and say, well, that somehow means the church. The 144,000, 12 from each of the 12 tribes, and then they're named the 12 tribes, and then they say, well, that's somehow that's the church. You know, well, it's absolutely impossible for it to be the church. That's why we're going to start in the Old Testament. You can't just leap into the book of Revelation. You have to start in Jeremiah. You have to start in Daniel. You have to have some sense of what's going on in Ezekiel. There is not a single chapter of Ezekiel that isn't either quoted or alluded to in the book of Revelation. Well, if you don't know that and you just go plunging in with a Gentile 20th century mindset, there's no way to make sense of it. Sure. Well, the first century church that received that book would have understood all that imagery and all the symbolism that's in it, because I'm jumping ahead of myself here in my introductory comments, but there's not an image or a symbol in the book of Revelation that you can't find somewhere else in the Bible interpreted for you. So there are many preachers out there who like to say, well, the Bible interprets the Bible, and then they won't let the Bible interpret the book of Revelation. It's much easier to just bump into these symbols and analogies and allegories and just kind of make up what it means, you know, and say, well, that just seems sensible. But they're all in the Bible packed away other places. I'll show you all that. We'll get to all of that. Now, there are a couple different hermeneutics that you have to take out. Hermeneutics, do you know what the word hermeneutic means? It actually does come from Hermes. Hermeneutics just means a method of interpretation. Hermeneutics applies to poetry. It applies to literature. There are many different forms of literature that have meaning on several different levels. And so hermeneutics is your approach to understanding the different levels that are written into it. A really good filmmaker will put several different levels of meaning into his film by the things he puts in the background, or the way that he cuts things together, or the way he uses light and shadow. If you're good with film and interpreting film, you'll watch that stuff, and each time you watch the movie, you'll go, oh, I didn't see that before, look at that, that adds something to it. Well, that's interpreting the movie, that's hermeneutics. Everybody approaches the Bible, especially the book of Revelation, with a hermeneutic that they're going to use, an approach that they're going to use to interpreting, because it does require some interpretation. There's no question that there are symbols in there, there are allegories in there. There's no question that there are analogies built inside the book of Revelation. And so you have to decide, how are we going to interpret these? How are we going to understand them? I am a very, and have been accused many times of being, a literalist. And I absolutely am. I make no apology for the fact that I am a face value literalist when it comes to interpreting scripture. Whatever the word says, and the plainest meaning of what it says, is always the best place to start. All too frequently, people start with what it says and then make a leap to what they would like to interpret it to be. I'll give you an example. Ezekiel's dry bones, Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel is in a valley of dry bones. And you know the story. He preaches to the bones. The bones join to their bone, to their bone. They stand up. They don't have any flesh on them. He preaches to the bones and the flesh covers them. And then he preaches to the wind and life is blown into them and they're standing up, a large group of people. I've heard pastor after pastor after pastor, minister after minister after minister, interpret that for me, for us, collectively. Interpret that as that is symbolic of the spiritual awakening and the spiritual life that Christians go through, because they see everything through that mindset of 20th century Gentile Christian. So they say, you know, we all start out as just dead bones. See, now we're interpreting. We all start out, you've heard it, haven't you? I don't even have to do the rest of it. We all start out as dead bones, but then, you know, we have some sinew and some muscle on us, but then God has to breathe in us to give us the spiritual life, and then we're the whole Christian. Unfortunately, what they don't do is read the rest of it where God interprets what that means. Now, to a literalist, he'll read the rest of it and say, now, since God has interpreted the meaning of what he did here, we're going to go with God's interpretation of what happened here. God's interpretation is, this is the whole house of Israel, which I will raise up on the last day. That's God's interpretation of what he just did with Ezekiel. You never hear that in most 20th century Gentile Christian church because they can't deal with that notion that God has announced in advance that he is going to raise up the house of Israel in the last days. But that's why he did it. The very next thing that Ezekiel does is that God tells him, now take two sticks and write on one of them for Ephraim and his fellows of Israel, and write on the other stick for Judah and his fellows in Israel, and then put the two sticks together, and as you walk with those two sticks together and people say, what mean these sticks? You tell them that in the last days, God is going to join Israel to Judah and bring them together back to Jerusalem. That's God's interpretation of what he had Ezekiel do. Now, if that's God's interpretation of what God said these things mean, as a literalist, I'm going to run with God and say, that's what these things mean. They mean that God is going to raise up the house of Israel, join Israel to Judah, and bring them back. Then you go to the book of Revelation, and you find God raising up the house of Israel and Judah, starting with the 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, and bringing them back to Jerusalem. The new Jerusalem comes down. God sends Jesus down to sit on the throne of David in Jerusalem and set up the kingdom that will never end. Well, that fits perfectly with what God said back here in Ezekiel. The only interpretive scheme that I've ever found, that I've ever studied, that I've ever been convinced of, the only interpretive scheme I've ever followed that doesn't do any damage to anything the Bible says is this face value literalist approach, because you're letting the word interpret the word, and as soon as you start allegorizing and making stuff up, you're bound to find and say things that contradict the word. That's the second approach. The first approach is the literalist view, or the literalist approach to reading the Bible, face value approach. Now, someone will jump up, just because there are always critics, and they'll say, well, you can't be literal of everything. You can't be a literalist. Jesus said, I'm a door. Does that mean he's a piece of wood with a doorknob on it? You're a literalist. No, of course not. As a literalist, I take the word to mean what it says, but we understand that there are allegories. We understand that there are analogies. And it's not too difficult to figure out what Jesus meant when he said, I'm the door. That's just not difficult. And either is it, again, when you get to the book of Revelation, as we start bumping into these symbols and these allegories, every one of them will fall into the groundwork we will have already done by the time we reach it. We'll get to those symbols that have flummoxed folks for most of their lives, and once you've done the groundwork in the Old Testament, you get to them and you go, oh, the four horsemen, I already know them. We saw them back in Ezekiel. They've already been here. We understand what they mean. So it's not difficult. Second approach to hermeneutic style is what's called the allegorical method, which I've already kind of referenced here. The allegorical method means that in any verse of the Bible that you look at, you move past the face value meaning, you go past what the words literally genuinely mean, and you look for a deeper meaning. You start with the assumption that there is a deeper meaning behind all of the words in the Bible, and so then you go look for those deeper meanings. You look for allegories. Now, this is not an unfair approach. When Paul talked about Hagar in the tent with Abraham, he said, these things are an allegory. And he said, Hagar and Abraham in the tent were analogous to them trying to work out in the flesh what God had already promised. And so Paul says that, yes, there are allegories in the Old Testament. The difficulty is when you get into the New Testament, where all of the things that were prophesied in the Old Testament are now starting to come to fruition, those are as Paul would say, the substance to the shadow that you saw in the Old Testament. The Old Testament gives you all these hints and shadows. The New Testament gives you the substance. Once you have the substance, stop allegorizing. You have it. It's here. This is exactly what we were looking for. You understand what I'm saying? For the first 300 years of the church, check me out, this is just a fact. For the first 300 years of the church's existence, from the time that Jesus walked and talked until the time of Constantine, the literal face value approach was the primary approach that the first church fathers and writers took. And when you see Paul utilize Old Testament scripture, when you see Matthew utilize Old Testament scripture, they take it very literally. They say, this was prophesied, and now here it is. It's completed. It's completed here in a physical sense. It actually happened. Jesus did come. Here it is. A virgin will give birth. Now a virgin has given birth. Here it is. Very literal, very definite. Around 300 AD, 325, into the time of Constantine, you begin to find the allegorical method introduced. Now, another thing that's interesting is that for the first 300 years of the church's existence, the primary millennial view was something called chiliasm, because millennium, our English word, comes from the Latin word millennia for 1,000. The Greek word for 1,000 is chiliad. There is also a Greek word chilioi, which means multiple thousands, which John uses when he talks about the thousands of angels. When he says that in heaven, there was a great company of people singing, and that there were thousands times thousands of angels, chilioi. Proving that John knew how to use the word multiple thousands. But when he talked about the 1,000 years in Revelation 20, he chose the word chiliad because he was specific, 1,000. But we'll get to all that. Now, the primary view for the first 300 years of the history of the church was what was called the chiliastic view, which was that the 1,000 years was literal and that Jesus would be back before the 1,000 years. 300 years, not argued anywhere. In fact, I have an article at home from Modern Reformation magazine. The article is actually called Why the Church Abandoned the Chiliastic View, in which it admits, because everybody who's done the historical work and every Bible scholar out there agrees that for the first 300 years of the church, the closer you get to the apostles, the closer you get to the people who wrote the Bible, the closer you get to the people who walked and talked with Jesus, the more firm this chiliastic premillennial view becomes. But from the time of Constantine and the introduction of the Christianizing of Rome, for the first time you find amillennial thought being introduced into theology. And it was introduced for this reason. As Rome became more powerful, and as the emperor of Rome also set himself up as the pope, we would call it now, but set himself up as the Holy Roman Emperor and tried to make Rome itself a holy empire ruled over by a god who was the emperor, it was not uncommon for people to rise up and point at Rome and at the Pope all the way through to the Reformation and point at the Pope and say, that's the Antichrist. You know, we've heard about this before, that's the Antichrist. We've heard about the city on seven hills, that's Rome. Clearly, the religion coming out of Rome would be it. Well, Rome's counter to that, the way to answer that was to say, you're interpreting wrongly. The way to interpret the book of Revelation is that it's such a deep and mystical book and so full of deep hidden meaning that you can't possibly know it, so only the high initiates of the church are allowed to even read it or see it, which is why the Catholic Church systematically made sure that there weren't Bibles in the hands of the common folk and that only the high initiates could read it. I have a Catholic Bible at home that clearly says in the introduction to the book, don't read this book. Don't read the book of Revelation. You can't understand it. Don't read it. Because they know the more you read it, the more you'll point at Rome and go, you know, a lot of this seems very familiar. Amillennialism was introduced to historic theology as a way to say, no, we're not it. You don't understand it. We're living in the millennium right now. This is the golden age, and the church is going to continue to expand and empower the world. And of course, when they say the church, they meant the Catholic Church is going to continue to expand and take over the planet. And as we do that, once we have conquered the planet, Christ will come back and we will hand him Peter's throne. Now, John Riesinger once said, and I think this is just a really good quote, and I was sitting there when he said it, but he once said, if you take a man and you put him in a room and you hand him a Bible and he's never read the Bible before, and you say, here, read this Bible. that man will never come out of that room an amillennialist. Because amillennialism is not in the Bible. It's something that has to be imported into Scripture and then imposed on it. If you leave a man alone and you let him read his Bible, he will come out a premillennialist, because all the language of the Bible says Jesus will come back and then there will be 1,000 years. It's just simply what the language does say. And then, of course, whenever it explains what the millennium is going to be like, it explains it like lions and lambs laying down together and children not being bit by snakes. And more importantly, in all the language of the Old Testament, and then carried into the New Testament, there is language about a kingdom that is coming that will never be destroyed, a kingdom that's inception will take place when Jesus himself returns from heaven and sits on David's throne. Now, to the amillennials, they will say, well, David's throne is the throne in heaven that Jesus is now sitting on at the right hand of God. See what they've just done? They've begun interpreting. Now we just begin allegorizing, and we say, well, it says that Jesus is on a throne right now. So that must be David's throne, because we're in the millennium, so he's on David's throne right now. Problem is, David never ruled in heaven. David ruled in Jerusalem, over Israel. That was David's throne. So when it says that Jesus is going to sit on David's throne, it means that he's going to rule over Israel in a physical throne in Jerusalem. That's the only way the Bible ever tells it. To go further than that and to say that the throne he's sitting on now is necessarily David's throne is to allegorize and go beyond what the Bible actually says and begin interpreting. And you know what I always say? I mean, if you're going to go down that line of just wild interpreting, where do you stop? There's no ground rules. You can really make up anything, you know? Jesus rode a donkey, and therefore we all need to ride donkeys because only holy people ride donkeys. And next thing you know, you go, wait, where are the ground rules here? How do you, you know? Jesus sailed off into the blue, therefore blue is Jesus' favorite color. So if you paint your house blue, he'll bless your house. And you know, you can just make up anything if you're going to start allegorizing. There is a kingdom coming. This kingdom was exactly the kingdom that Jesus had his 12 apostles walking around talking about. When Jesus told his apostles to go out the first time in pairs, he said to them, don't go into any of the Gentiles, don't go into the Gentile cities, only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and tell them the kingdom of God is at hand. Tell them the gospel of the kingdom. Well, when he walked around using that kind of language, the only kingdom that the Jews would have thought of, because he said, don't go to the Gentiles, only go to the Jews, only go to the Israelites and the lost tribes of Israel, which we'll get to maybe tonight. Once he said lost tribes of Israel, he's talking to people who know their Old Testament Daniel. They know their Old Testament Isaiah and Jeremiah. They know the promise of the kingdom in Hosea. They know all these promises, and they're waiting for the kingdom. So when they hear the Messiah is here and the kingdom is among you, they're not thinking kingdom in heaven and him sitting on the right hand of God. They're thinking, oh good, the Messiah is here. He's come to set up the kingdom. It's the only kingdom they would have known. It's the only one they would have understood. So then they came to him and they said, now, they said, you know, John the Baptist has taught his apostles to pray, and his disciples, why don't you teach us to pray? And he said, okay, when you pray, say this, our Father who art in heaven, holy is your name. Thy kingdom come and thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, we've lost what that means. 2,000 years has gone by, and we think when we say that, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, we don't even think about what we're saying anymore. When Jesus said that to Jewish disciples who were out teaching only Israelites, he said, now, when you pray, pray that the kingdom comes. The only kingdom they could think of was, yeah, that kingdom that David's throne and that Ezekiel said the two groups would be joined, and they'll come back to Jerusalem when Messiah's here, and he'll set up his kingdom. Perfect. This is perfect for me. He included it in his prayer. Next time you say the Lord's Prayer, think about what you're saying. Your kingdom come where? To earth, and thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Not your kingdom in an amillennial sense, hang out in heaven somewhere. Your kingdom come to earth, and then your will be done, which perfectly fits him saying, when the new covenant is established, no one will hurt nor harm in all my holy mountain. My will be done in all of them because I will be their God, they will be my people, and I will put my law in their hearts. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You get that language? It's inescapable language once you think about it, but we don't ever think about it. It's just too easy to walk by. So, the first kingdom that ever kept Israel in bondage, do you know what it is?
Egypt.
Abrahamic covenant, Abrahamic promise. He has two kids. God says, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Through Isaac has Jacob. The promise continues to Jacob, which is why whenever God talks about the new covenant, he says, I will remember my promise that I made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your forefathers. Right? Jacob and Esau wrestle in the womb. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. God chose again which way the blessed seed would go. Jacob has 12 sons. They become the progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. One of them, Joseph, he's working in Potiphar's house. While he's working for Potiphar, Potiphar's wife decides that she'd like to have a little, you know, private time with Joseph because he's apparently a pretty good-looking guy. He says, nada, and she grabs his toga. He books out of the house without the toga. She yells rape, and he's running through the house naked. Not good. So he ends up in prison. While he's in prison, it occurs to some of his prisoners that he can, occurs to some of the prisoners. They have some dreams. He interprets their dreams. One of them is loosed from the prison, goes back to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I've had this dream. I need someone to interpret the dream. And he says, I know this guy, Joseph, who can interpret your dream. Joseph shows up and says, so what was your dream? And he says, seven fat cows came up out of the Nile. And then seven thin cows came up and they ate the fat cows. And he says, well, what's that mean? And Joseph said, here's what it means. You're about to have 7 years of plenty. God's about to bless you and give you 7 years of unbelievable abundance. But after that, you're going to have 7 years of famine. And those 7 years of famine are going to eat up all that abundance that you had to begin with. So if I were you, king, what I would do is, I would make sure that through those 7 years, that there was as much grain and everything put away as there could possibly be to get ready for the 7 years of famine, and then you'll get through it okay. Pharaoh says, I'm going to put you in charge of that. You're clearly a man of God. You have the mind of God. You're in charge. Well, he ends up being second only to Pharaoh in all of Egypt. By the time he gets done doling out the grain for 7 years, everybody has given up all their animals, all their land, all their everything to Pharaoh. Pharaoh ends up, and Joseph ends up, owning everything there is in Egypt because people give up everything they own for food during the 7 years of famine, increasing Pharaoh and Joseph's power to the point where they own everybody and everything in Egypt. Anyway, during this famine, I don't have time to preach about this, but God brought a famine to all of Egypt just to drive Joseph's brothers to come bow down in front of Joseph. This is a very sovereign God we're dealing with here. So his brothers come and bow down to him exactly the way the promise was, or the dream was, when Joseph was a kid, where he saw bales of hay, and their bales of wheat and hay all bow down to his bale of hay. And then he got the great coat of many colors. And then he said, I had a dream, and I saw the stars of the heaven and the sun and the moon, and you all did obeisance to me. And the brothers all said, like, we're going to bow down to you. Right. So God causes a famine for 7 years. They come and they bow down to him. He sets them up as kings, Hyksos, the shepherd kings, who rule in Egypt for a while. But the book of Exodus begins, there rose up a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph. And having risen up and not knowing Joseph, he realizes that there's so many Israelites in Egypt that if they ever side with the enemies, they're a formidable army. The only thing to do is conquer those people while they're still in our country, and they put them all into slavery, and they serve there for 400 years. Now, when God spoke to Abraham, I'm backing up again. When God spoke to Abraham, he said, you're going to have a child of promise. And he said, how can this be? I'm 90, she's 80. We're well past childbearing years. How can this possibly be? God put him to sleep, passed through, made a covenant with himself. I don't have time to tell you all this, but you know most of this. Made a covenant with himself and said to Abraham, here's how you're going to know it's going to be true. Here's how I'm going to tell you that it's going to be true. Your descendants are going to go into a land where they're not known, and they're going to serve there for 400 years, and they're going to come out richer than when they went in, and I'm going to bring them back to this very land and give them this land as an inheritance. So the Israelites serve for exactly 400 years in Egypt. And then Moses comes along and leads them back to Jerusalem, leads them back to Israel, and gives them the very land of Canaan that God promised to Abraham. This is a very sovereign God we're talking about. Egypt, number one. I'm going to have to move faster than this. They leave Egypt and they go to the land of Canaan. When they get the law, God tells them, now one of the things that you have to do to follow my law is that you have to keep my Sabbaths. Every seventh day, no work. Every seventh year, a Sabbath year where you're going to let the land lay fallow so that the land can have its Sabbaths. Every seven sevens, every 49 years, the 50th year is going to be a year of Jubilee. Let the land lay fallow, and everything, every land allotment that I've given goes back to its original owner. Every slave in Israel goes free. and everybody starts again from scratch so that they would end up with exactly what God had promised each of them. So the Israelites don't do it. Decide, we'll do it our way. So, you know, their first king, they went through a period of the judges. That's what the book of Judges is about. And then they came and said to Samuel, we'd like to have a king because the other nations around us have a king. So God gives them King Saul, and he says, now I'm going to give you a king, but he's going to ransack you. He's going to take all your money. He's going to take the best women. He's going to take all the food. He's going to take all the most talented people, but I'll give you a king. He gives them King Saul. Meanwhile, Samuel's over there anointing this shepherd boy, David, and says, you're going to be the king of Israel, man after God's own heart. David becomes king and moves the capital from Hebron to Jerusalem. And for the first time, all 12 tribes of Israel are ruled from Jerusalem, from David's throne. And it's the last time that you see all 12 tribes of Israel united as a kingdom is under David's rulership and David's kingdom. That's why this language about Jesus ruling on David's throne is so important. It's the only time that Israel was ever united as 12 families, 12 houses as one nation was under David. Solomon comes along, builds Solomon's temple. We'll get into temple stuff in the weeks to come. Solomon builds a temple, and as it's being built, of course, Solomon loves many strange women. Not surprising considering the number of concubines and wives that he had. You've got to guess there's going to be some strange ones in there. What it really meant was foreign women. He loved many foreign women. Instead of only taking wives and concubines, that would be an allegory, yeah, for many strange women. What he did was he took on women from foreign countries who brought in their foreign gods, and he, in order to appease his wives and concubines and keep the party going, decided that rather than throw the foreign gods out, that he would embrace these foreign gods. And so he was told that he was going to lose the nation, and that the northern 10 tribes, because they hadn't kept the Sabbaths and because they hadn't followed God and put off these foreign gods, Jeroboam, who was the servant to Solomon, was going to become the king of the northern tribes. And you read in 1 Kings that no sooner did he become king than he immediately apostatized, and he realized that if they ever all worshiped the same God, they would all go back to the same king. So Jeroboam said, I know the best way for me to stay king of these 10 tribes I'm now king of is to give them new gods. And so apostasy and foreign god worship ran rampant over the northern 10 tribes, which from that point forward became known as, and this is a very important distinction, get this distinction now. The northern kingdom, the 10 tribes over which Jeroboam ruled, from that point forward were known by two names. They were called Israel, or they were called Ephraim, over the chief tribe Ephraim. The southern kingdom, which was Judah, Benjamin, and the Levites, because they had to serve in the temple and the temple was in Jerusalem, so the Levites stayed in the southern kingdom for the most part, was from that point forward known as Judah, because Judah was the primary tribe down there. Whenever you say the word Jew, you are saying the short version of Judahite, someone who is from the southern kingdom. Now, there are a great many people who are Israelites out there in the world, who are ancestors of the northern tribes, the northern kingdoms, who are not Jews. You understand that? Every Jew is an Israelite in that he is one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Every Jew and Israelite is a Hebrew in that they are descendants of Abraham, who was the first Hebrew, which just means sojourner, wanderer, man without a country. But not every Israelite is a Jew. People from the northern kingdom were Israelites and never Judahites. Only Judah, Benjamin, and the Levites were ever referred to as Jews historically, ever. The northern tribes, however, were put into a bondage to Assyria. The second great bondage that Israel underwent, the northern tribes, was Assyria, the Assyrian captivity. Now, while the northern tribes were in captivity to Assyria, Jeremiah, Tom, you got a Bible on you?
Sure.
Okay. Jeremiah 25:11. Look at that real quick. Anybody who wants to turn over there, look at it. We're going to have Tom read it for us. The southern tribe, Judah, remained intact, even though the northern tribes had gone off into the Assyrian captivity. But at the time, Babylon was conquering Assyria. Babylon, under King Nebuchadnezzar, took over that whole portion of the Middle East that we now call Iraq who were on our way into bomb, by the way. But don't tell me the Bible's not relevant. So anyway, God told through Jeremiah, who was the prophet to Judah, the southern kingdom. And that's another thing, by the way, when you're reading the prophets, and we'll deal with this as we work our way through prophecy, you have to understand when the prophets speak, whether they're speaking to the southern or the northern kingdom. There's a lot of different kingdom prophecies going on here. Jeremiah was a prophet to the southern kingdom, Judah, that were still intact, while the northern kingdom were in Assyria, while Nebuchadnezzar's armies were conquering Assyria and Babylon was rising. Got that? So here's the prophecy that Jeremiah gave specifically to the southern kingdom that was still intact. 25:11 of Jeremiah says this. Would you read it, Tom?
This whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years.
Read the next verse too, because I think it says it again.
But when the 70 years are fulfilled, I will punish the king of Babylon and his nation, the land of the Babylonians, for their guilt, declares the Lord.
Okay, so here's Jeremiah saying, because you have not kept the Sabbath and because you have not worshipped God, as this Babylonish king is starting to conquer Assyria, God tells the southern kingdom, I'm going to turn you over to Babylon for 70 years. 70 years you're going to be in bondage to Babylon. Now, if you've noticed anything so far, you should notice this. God said, for 400 years you'll be in Egypt. You know how long they were in Egypt?
400 years.
400 years. He then said, you're going to go to Babylon for 70 years. Do you know how many years they were actually in Babylon? Everybody agrees. There's nobody who debates this. You know how long they were in Babylon?
70 years.
Yeah. So when you get to the book of Revelation and John says he's going to rule and reign on earth for 1,000 years. See, there's nowhere else in the Bible, anywhere in the Bible, where the numbers have been inaccurate. Historically, the Bible is always numerically exactly accurate, which is why I think it's very funny when people get to 1,000 years and suddenly go, time to allegorize. Time to make stuff up now, because historically, the Bible has always numerically been exactly accurate. 7 years, he says, you're going to be in there. So the next captivity coming up, particularly for the southern kingdom, Babylon. Now, the Babylonish captivity took place in two waves. The first thing they did was they came in and they took all the rich and powerful people, because you want to start by conquering the rich and powerful people, and then you can come back and take the everyday folk, like me. And so the first wave of deportees out of Jerusalem up into Babylon was the rich and the powerful, and that's where you find Daniel and the Hebrew children that were with him, who were well-educated and studied and wealthy and part of the higher echelon. They went into Babylon in that first wave. Later, there was a second wave of deportees that were all the slaves and the common people. Now, we won't get to it tonight, but next week I'm going to start in the book of Daniel. And we're going to start where Daniel is reading the book of Jeremiah. And he's reading exactly what Tom just read. And that's what we're going to pick up next week, is God then comes and says to him, all right, since I've told you everything that's going to happen to your people in advance, since I told you about the 400 years and I told you about the 70 years, I'm going to tell you about some more years. And he lays out 490 years of Israel's history. And it has come true exactly. He predicts everything from Cleopatra to Alexander the Great, and hits every single one of them. So much so that the critics of the book of Daniel have tried very hard to late date Daniel and say, well, in fact, again, my Catholic Bible that I have at home, in the beginning of the book of Daniel, it actually says this was an apocryphal book that was written after the fact, because there's no way Daniel could have known these things. He was that accurate. So we're going to get into all that. Babylon, while Daniel was still in Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire conquered Babylon. The Medes and the Persians. Do you know what the current name for Persia is?
Iran.
Iran is now Persia. Again, the focus of world history at this particular moment happens to be Jerusalem, Iraq, Iran. Duh. That was the fourth of the kingdoms that conquered. They conquered while Daniel was still there. Isaiah predicted that God was going to raise up a Persian king named Cyrus, and that Cyrus the king was going to let his people go back. So what happens? Well, the Medo-Persians conquer Babylon. And who's their king? A little guy named Cyrus, what a surprise. And then Cyrus, during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, let them go back, releases them. For no good reason, Cyrus, this Persian king, says, well, then I'm going to make a decree, and you figure out what you need in terms of manpower and guards and army to take you all the way there. And what are you going to need in terms of lumber? What are you going to need? And you go back and you rebuild your temple. And he lets them go. It's unbelievable. So it's one of those things that the critics of the Bible, who are historians, still read and scratch their head. It's inexplicable. Nowhere in history has any powerful king of a Middle Eastern nation said, you know what, let's do this. Let's take the slaves and let them go. So what happened was the southern kingdom, the Judahites, came back to rebuild their temple. But during the time of the Assyrian captivity, one of the things that the Assyrian king had done was, once he had taken the northern kingdom out of the land of Canaan, he then put his own people in Canaan and occupied the area. So when the northern kingdom began heading back for their own land, there were already people living there. As a consequence, they never reestablished themselves as the northern kingdom. Instead, they scattered themselves through Middle Europe. We'll follow all that later. And they became what's called the Lost Tribes. That's where the Lost Tribes language comes from. Rather than come back and establish themselves in Canaan, they became wandering groups of people, wandering nomadic huge groups of people who also worked as armies and could be bought for a price, and at one point fought against Judah as an army for hire. Some, however, did go back to Canaan and ended up cross-marrying with the Assyrians that already lived there. Those people then were known as Samaritans, the people who came back and crossbred. That's why Jesus would talk about Samaritans as dogs. That's what it meant. Half-breeds, Israelites who gave up the true Israelitish heritage and had crossbred with Assyrians who are now Samaritans, which, by the way, puts a great twist on the Good Samaritan story. Because Jesus, when he told the story, said, you know, first a Pharisee came by and walked to the other side, and scribe came by, ooh, look at him. Then a Samaritan, a dog, the people that the Israelites would have most hated, came by and did a good thing for this man. And then Jesus says, now, of them, who was his brother? Oh, I'll see. Great story. Okay, don't have time to preach that. Gotta go. Medo-Persian Empire was the next empire that kept Israel under bondage. During the time of Nehemiah, there was a king, Artaxerxes, who put out a second decree that not only should the temple be rebuilt, but that the walls of the city should be rebuilt and the streets as well. Now, this was a completely different thing. It was one thing to say to a conquered people, you can go back and build your temple, but don't rebuild your walls. If you rebuild your walls, then it's going to be hard to fight with you again. But Artaxerxes allowed them to come back, rebuild the city, rebuild the wall. And that's during the time of Nehemiah when it says that they used to that they worked with a shovel in one hand and a spear in the other. Sword in one hand, trowel in the other. That's where the Sword and Trowel magazine got its name. Sword in one hand, trowel in the other, because they had to fight the whole time they were working, because all their enemies are going, hey, they're building the city and the walls and everything. They're going to come take over this area again. Sort of like what's happening now. Hey, look, the Jews have come back and they're building again. Hey, we got to stop this. We got to put a stop to it. Nothing ever changes. After the Medo-Persian Empire, the southern kingdom was now reestablished. From a theological standpoint, let me tell you real quick, the reason that the northern tribes could be scattered was because when Jacob, who had had his name changed to Israel, when he was blessing his 12 sons and he was going through all their blessings, he specifically said of Judah that it was through Judah that Shiloh would come, who would have the law giving, that the scepter would never depart from Judah, and that Judah would rule until Shiloh came, Christ. So it was absolutely necessary that God keep the southern kingdom, Judah, intact until Shiloh came. And then, of course, Jesus did come. 70 years later, he scattered them too. But he had to keep them intact long enough for the Christ to come, which he exactly did, because this is a sovereign God we're dealing with. Okay, the Medo-Persians were conquered by the Grecian Empire. Who said Greece earlier? Whoever it was. Well, you're here now. It's number 5.
Thanks.
Greece is the word. That's right. This is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquered the Medo-Persians and took over Babylon. They all wanted to rule from Babylon. Alexander the Great died in his middle 30s. from some kind of consumption and drunken party in the outside, in the moats outside of Babylon, crying because there were no more worlds to conquer. You're in your mid-30s now. What have you done with your life? This guy conquered the world. And the Grecian Empire, everybody knows, the Grecian Empire was overtaken by
Rome.
Rome conquered Greece through a bit of chicanery and a stomping army and a woman named Cleopatra and all sorts of political intrigue. Now, these are the six historic nations. I'm going to say this and we're going to call it a night. These are the six historic nations. Nobody questions this. This is history. Nobody can debate this. Nobody can argue this. These are literal, earthly, physical, actual nations that ever conquered and controlled Jerusalem, Judah, Israel. You got that? However, every time these nations are talked about, there's always a seventh. It's never about six nations. Throughout the Bible, it's always about a seventh nation that will rule over Israel. It's called a ten-toed nation in Daniel. It's called a ten-horned nation in the book of Revelation. And whenever it's talked about, whether it's Daniel calling it the little horn, John calling it the Antichrist, whether it's the book of Revelation calling it the little horn who was stouter than his fellows, the language is always the same, that there's going to be one more world ruler. There's going to be one more Nebuchadnezzar. There's going to be one more Cyrus. There's going to be one more Alexander the Great who's going to rise up and create a ten-nation confederacy, a loose confederacy. And it is during the time of that ten-nation confederacy, and I'm going to tell you right now, by the way, just so we can leap straight to this and I'll prove it to you later, it's not the European Union. All these people writing these books, stop it. It's not the European Union. I'm going to tell you now, the ten-nation confederacy and this little horn, and I'll prove it to you because it's right in the Bible. I don't know why people don't bother to read their Bible. He will come out of the area of Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Transjordan, Syria. That's the area that he's coming out of. It's the area that was ruled by one of Alexander's generals. When Alexander died, his kingdom was given up to four generals. Daniel talks about it in detail. And of those four generals, one of them, Seleucid Nicator, takes over what we now know as the Middle East. And then Daniel tells us that the little horn comes up out of the area of Seleucid Nicator. Why not bother to read this? But wouldn't it make sense that the ancient enemies of Israel that have always been the descendants of Esau, when Jesus said in Matthew 24, when you see Jerusalem encompassed about by the Gentiles, the Esauites, the Edomites, your ancient enemies, exactly the people who at this very moment are trying to encompass Jerusalem. Then Jesus said, watch for that, that's coming, and of course it all is. There's a seventh kingdom coming. Now, one of the key features of this seventh kingdom, which for the moment I'll just call the ten-toe kingdom, and I'll show you references to it in the weeks to come. When this kingdom ends, Christ shows up. Throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, that kingdom is the kingdom that is destroyed by the return of Christ. So, for the amillennial folks out there, however else you might want to interpret the millennium, the reason I am a premillennialist is one of the descriptions of the millennium is that during the millennium, Christ is sitting on his throne in Jerusalem. That hasn't happened yet. And Christ comes back at the end of the last nation that will rule over Jerusalem, the last Gentile, Esauite, Edomite nation that will conquer Jerusalem. So there have historically been a lot of people who have been, people have postulated, well, that's the Antichrist, or that's the little horn. And we'll talk about that as we go forward, you know, where they'll say, well, when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD by, well, Titus was the Roman general, right, who did it, that was, you know, the Antichrist destroying, and that's the end of it. But Christ didn't come back. Before that, during the Maccabean rebellion,
Antiochus
Epiphanes, thank you. You are the other half of my brain. Antiochus Epiphanes. the time of the Maccabean Rebellion, there are a lot of people who point at that and say, that was Daniel's little horn. But Christ didn't come back. 50 years ago, people said it was Hitler. Hitler is clearly the Antichrist. Look, he's persecuting Jews. Christ didn't come back. Whoever you're going to point at historically and say the last kingdom has arrived, unless Christ came back, that last kingdom hasn't arrived. And the particular attributes that that kingdom has to have is that it has to be a 10-nation confederacy based around one guy, and the deal he's going to make is that he's going to reestablish the covenant that was made by Artaxerxes that you can go back and rebuild the walls and rebuild your temple. What's happening in Israel right now? They're trying to rebuild the temple. They want to rebuild that temple. That's what they mostly want, rebuild that temple. There's going to be some Middle Eastern king rise up and make a 10-nation confederacy and say, okay, I'll make you a deal. You can build your temple. When that happens, the clock starts ticking again. But we're waiting for that last kingdom to show up. It hasn't yet. Not since the end of the Roman Empire. We have been living in a time that Paul would call the times of the Gentiles. And in Romans 11 would say, when the times of the Gentiles are closed, he's going to graft back in those wild olive branches that he cut off, those 10 tribes that have been scattered, and just like it said in Ezekiel, he's going to bring them back, unite them with the southern tribes, and he's going to reestablish Israel and Judah, and Christ is going to come, wipe out the Antichrist once and for all, set up his kingdom for 1,000 years that will never be defeated. That's the Bible story. There, you don't ever have to come back. I just gave you the entire premillennial view. What I'm going to do from here forward is prove that to you. Just like we've taken 6 months and said, okay, biblical soteriology looks like this. These are the 5 points, and this is how God saves people. I have always started by saying, here's the big picture. Here it is. And then I've taken the time to give you all the details and answering all the questions so that when we get to the end, you'll be convinced of why I'm convinced of the position.
You'll show the demons that are in between the kings.
Oh, all that is in there. Oh, yeah. The other thing that you've got, what Joel is referring to, because he's been through some of these studies with us before, is that each of the kings who ruled over these nations were demonically inspired, as Daniel will clearly talk about. And so the reason this guy will be such a world conqueror and world ruler is that he's not going to be a typical guy. It's not going to be like Todd running for office. It's going to be a guy who has such an internal evil spiritual power that, as Paul said, God will turn the world over to a strong delusion so that they will believe the lie and be damned. And that's powerful. Okay. Yes?
Since the Catholic Church is on the
altar. Yeah. Okay. And I'd have to go with a yeah on that one.
Going with that yeah. premise or whatever, do you think that that's the reason, that whole thing about Christ being on the throne in Jerusalem is the reason why the Pope wants to have this?
No doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, the Pope has always wanted to set up his throne in Jerusalem. He wants to rule from Jerusalem. Absolutely. And we don't have time to really get into it tonight, but when you look at the Antichrist, he has the false prophet. And the false prophet is a world religious figure who is going to rule from Jerusalem. you know.
Yeah.
So, okay, so there's so much to say. There's so much to cover. That was the big introduction right there. The reformers in the 1500s, Calvin, Luther, these guys were all Catholic. As a result, their eschatology was Catholic amillennial eschatology. So when they created their theology, Reformed theology, which we do adhere to, they spent very little time on eschatology. And what little they did was amillennial because they didn't reform their eschatology. They reformed their soteriology.
There was no Israel at the time.
And at the time, there hadn't been an Israel for 1,500 years. So it's very easy to say, well, there's been no Israel. What about all these promises to Israel? I guess we'll just start making stuff up. You know, we'll start, well, he means the church when he says Israel. He clearly means the church. 1948 comes around, there's an Israel, and there's Jews, and there's, well, you know. My point is this. Most people who are consistent Calvinists, if you're going to be consistent with Calvin and his total theology, they then embrace amillennialism because that was Calvin's view. It was Calvin's view because Calvin was Catholic, and he took his Catholic amillennial view and imported it into his total theology. And so when I came along and said, well, I agree with Calvin's soteriology, I don't agree with his ecclesiology, by the way. I don't agree with burning people at the stake. I mean, I think that's a little rough. You know, I don't agree with using the power of the state to make people go to church. That's what Calvin did. So there are a lot of things about Calvin I disagree with. But I agree with the Calvinistic soteriology of how people get saved in the sovereignty of God. But I disagree completely with his eschatology. And as a result, that's made me a bit of an oddity, I guess I'll say, among Calvinistic preachers. Because they say, well, if you're Calvinistic, you're all millennial. I say, no, I'm Calvinistic premillennial. They go, well, you can't be. Well, yeah, I can. Watch me. You know? Because the Bible does not teach three views. The Bible does not teach a premillennial, amillennial, and postmillennial view any more than it teaches multiple views of salvation. It teaches one view of salvation, and it teaches one eschatology. And the two, the soteriology of Calvin and the premillennial eschatology, happen to fit together just like this. It's just a beautiful thing. And I've had people through the years try to convert me, and I've read all the books, and I've read all the amillennial stuff, and I've taken on all the stuff, and all it did was convince me of the premillennial view. And pre-trib, and yeah, I'm pre-everything. I'm so pre, I won't go to the post office. That's how I'm so pre, I won't eat post toasties. That was David's joke. So that's where we're picking up next week. Next week, we're going to look at Daniel and Daniel's 70 weeks, 77s, 490 years that God predicts for Israel, Daniel's people, and Jerusalem, Daniel's city. Got it? That's where we start next week. We will. I was hoping people would be enthusiastic about this study. Oh.